still an hour and a half before sunrise. It's 12 midday in the UK. Jane Royce has the BBC News.
Within the last half hour, the Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian has appeared on state television, claiming that the US and Israel want to sow chaos and disorder in Iran and accused the two countries of ordering riots. Earlier, the National Police Chief said there had been significant arrests in response to the widespread protests. Reports suggest hundreds of people may have been killed or wounded in a crackdown by security forces. Hospital staff have told the BBC they've been overwhelmed with casualties. The Speaker of Iran's Parliament has warned President Trump that any US military intervention in support of the anti-government protests would be met with retaliation. In his first interview since being sacked as the UK's ambassador to Washington, Lord Mandelson has refused to apologise to Jeffrey Epstein's victims for continuing their friendship after the financier was convicted of being a paedophile. However, Lord Mandelson did apologise to the women for a system which refused to listen to them. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, he said he'd been kept away from the sexual side of his friend's life because he was gay. Epstein took his own life in jail in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. The Conservatives say they would ban under-16s from using social media if they were in power, following the example of Australia. The Labour government doesn't back the change, but insists it is ensuring children can only access age-appropriate content online. One person's died and around 300 homes and buildings have been destroyed in bushfires that have been raging across southeast Australia for several days. A state of emergency has been declared in Victoria. The blazes are being fuelled by very hot, dry and windy conditions. Japan's beginning an expedition to try to extract rare earth minerals from 6,000 metres under the sea in an attempt to reduce its dependence on China. A Japanese deep-sea scientific drilling boat is heading to the remote Pacific island of Minami Torishima. The seabed there is believed to contain an abundance of the highly prized materials. And the weather, cloudy and windy this afternoon with outbreaks of rain pushing eastwards. The rain will be heavier in northern areas and it will become drier in many parts this evening and generally mild. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. And now, continuing our focus on the US, Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today is the American Broadway star, Vanessa Williams.
Vanessa Williams is musical theatre royalty. She's worked with Stephen Sondheim on Broadway and is currently commanding the London stage as the fearsome fashion editor Miranda Priestly in the musical The Devil Wears Prada. She's also topped the American pop charts, starred in Hollywood movies with the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and played key roles in prize-winning television series, including Ugly Betty. And before all that, she was crowned Miss America 1984, the first black American to take the title, although she was later forced to relinquish it in controversial circumstances. Her family supported her through that ordeal, and there's been no holding her back since then. Vanessa, some of your choices today come from your homeland, including music by Aaron Copland, Jennifer Higdon, Samuel Barber and Leonard Bernstein. But we're starting with a movement from a Bach orchestral suite, and this is widely known as Air on the G-String, but a recording on the flute. Why this?
Well, my parents are both music teachers. My father was an instrumental music teacher, and we had lessons at our house every day after school. So I grew up listening to lessons upstairs and then downstairs on the piano where my mother would be teaching. And in between lessons, I would hear my dad fiddle around. And this piece was always one that he would do on the flute. So it immediately reminds me of my dad kind of warming up in between his students upstairs.
Thank you.
music by Bach, the Orchestral Suite No. 3 in D major, and that was the Air on the G String, played by James Galway, with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Barry Griffiths. Actually, I think Vanessa Williams' music brought your parents together, didn't it?
Absolutely. My parents met when they were at Fredonia College in New York, and they were there for music education. So my mother was a vocal major and my father was instrumental.
So yeah. One became a band teacher. And what did your mom do?
She taught choral music in Westchester County, which is north of New York City.
How much do you think that influenced your life, having music all the way around you when you were such a young age?
Oh, tremendously. Not only did we hear music all the time, but, well, both of them taught school, so we would have to go to their holiday concerts. So sitting through a choral concert and band concert every year was part of the requirements. But they also insisted on us taking musical instruments until we graduated high school. So I started piano, and then I started French horn, of course, recorder. We all started on recorder, and we continued until we graduated high school. So I was in marching band and orchestra and concert band and chorus and concert choir. So it definitely shaped my musical background. I know how to read music. I can walk into a studio and be a musician and say, I need to see the sheet music. I don't want to have to figure it out by ear. Show me the charts. So it helps with my profession.
You must feel, as so many musicians do, that it's so important that young children are exposed to music at a young age, because it's the sociological aspect as well as the artistic one, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it helps the brain. You know, unfortunately, music programs are always the first ones to be cut in any kind of public school situation, which is horrible, just because it's not that everyone has to go into music as a career, but it definitely helps shape the brain. And it's a great opportunity to allow arts to be revered and appreciated.
Do you have much choice in the music you played, or were you very strongly directed by parents and teachers?
No, I had choice. I definitely had choice of what I played, but I did not have a choice when I had to compete or audition for all state and all county. And so I did the Mozart horn concerto with my mother was playing, and yeah, so I remember slogging through that, trying to make it perfect, and I ended up getting into all county.
Well, that's pretty good, because the horn is the most difficult brass instrument, probably, just as the oboe is in the woodwind.
Well, my brother played oboe, and I played French horn.
Gosh, you had a little orchestra there, then.
Exactly.
Well, next music by an English composer who celebrated his 80th birthday just a few months ago, John Rutter.
Well, this reminds me of, I grew up Catholic, and when I've done a lot of recording, kind of the hardest genre for me to jump into is gospel and riffing, because I certainly heard it in my lifetime, but my weekly and spiritual musical center was always kind of the Catholic Church, and my parents also sang a baroque choir, so the classics were something that was very easy for me. So this reminds me of church. It reminds me of going to holiday concerts where we'd have to listen to my parents be part of a baroque choir. My dad was a tenor. My mother was a soprano.
Gosh, you've got a vocal ensemble as well as an orchestra.
Yes. So this just reminds me of church growing up and just the tradition of it all.
Thank you.
Christ is the Morning Star, composed and conducted by John Rutter, and performed by the Cambridge Singers with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Was the rhythm of family life very affected by the Catholic Church for you, do you think?
Not particularly. I think what I loved about having two teachers as parents, the rhythm of just knowing that things would be always the same. You know, when I look back on my life, it was very protected. It was very predictable, which gives you comfort.
And your mother played the organ?
Yes.
So your role?
My role was to turn pages. my mother used to play organ for our church and also for wedding, you know, ceremonies. So I remember as a child in the balcony and looking at what the bride was wearing, what color the bridesmaids had on, and then, you know, turning pages for my mom as she... Because my mom used to play in church growing up as a child, her and her two sisters. So she passed away last year. And even while she was in the intensive care unit, you could see her fingers going, just, you know, fingering the keys in as her kind of her default.
Yeah, hearing know. The music internally.
Hearing the music, yes, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You grew up in a small hamlet, Millwood, mm-hmm. in New York State. What was the community there like?
Well, we were about an hour outside New York City. So, you know, the city was available via train or car. But we had like a, you know, an acre and a half of land. My dad was not only a musician, but loved to build. So he put in a pool and decks and all kinds of additions to the home. He also built a house in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. So we had a summer house that we would go and visit. And there was a ski slope across the street. So, you know, for two Black Americans, you know, growing up and raising children starting in the 60s, they really did have the American dream. They owned their own house. They had properties. They, you know, were thriving in their careers, were well loved in the community. And when I look back, I said, that is what the American dream is all about.
Well, talking of the American dream, the next music sums up the American landscape, doesn't mm-hmm. it?
Absolutely. The next piece is by my dad's favorite, and I mentioned going to the Poconos. So back then, we would have a van, and it wasn't a camper van, but a Ford van, and there were 8-track tapes. And when we would make our trips to the Poconos, which is about 2 hours from my house, we would always listen to tapes. Sometimes it was Bill Withers, but Aaron Copland was my dad's absolute favorite composer. So I grew up listening to the Billy the Kid Suite and imagining what it was like in my mind when you hear the gunshots and the, you know, duels that were brought to life through Aaron Copland's music. And he also lived near us in New York. So it was kind of, I think he lived on the other side of the Hudson River. So we always knew that Aaron Copland was close by.
So Appalachian couldn't be more appropriate.
Yes.
Thank you. That music expresses not just a feeling of the countryside, but that sort of hope of a young country.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So extraordinary how composers can summon up the landscape there in Britain in the Sea Pictures and, you know, Elgar and the Malvern Hills.
Right. And it seems like the Western frontier is all there waiting for you.
Yeah, and Bernstein and all the naughtiness of New York. I mean, we'll come on to that. We heard the opening of Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, the suite version for orchestra played by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spano. So at what point did you realise you were going to be a performer?
Well, I took dance starting at three, and my mother was a huge lover of dance and would take me to see Alvin Ailey every year and the Nutcracker. She loved watching me dance and knew that I had talent as a dancer. And it wasn't until probably when I was 12 or so and I started doing musicals at school and they noticed, oh, Well, she can do both dancing and singing and acting. And it was when I was doing like summer community theater, high school productions, that they said, well, if you want to have a career in this, we will support you. Let's get some training. And so they never said, get a real job. Don't waste your time. So I was supported from the very beginning. So I would say when I was a teenager, when I knew that I could do all three, dancing, acting and singing together, and then start getting lead roles, which I
did. You were effectively out in the sticks, Vanessa.
Yeah.
So did you tend to head into New York City to see shows?
Oh, yes. Mm. All the time. And we did have a thriving community theater scene. But Broadway was just a train ride away. So it was very easy. I saw Gregory Hines. I saw The Wiz when it, with Stephanie Mills when it first came out. I remember seeing Danny Kaye. He would do a kind of an introduction to opera and orchestra at the Metropolitan Opera House. So I had an opportunity to see stars just, a train ride away and know that that could possibly be a reality.
You went on to major in musical theater at Syracuse mm-hmm. University. So were you beginning to realize that this was the way to fulfill your dreams, that you could do both singing and dancing?
Yeah. There were only five schools that actually gave you a Bachelor of Fine Arts in musical theater. And I applied to all of them and got accepted to all of them. And my parents said, well, you're going to go to the one that we want, which is close by, and we'll give you the campus experience, which they really wanted. And in retrospect, I understand why they didn't want me to go right into the city. Carnegie Mellon was too expensive at the time. They didn't want to remortgage the house, which I understand. One was out in California, and they go, no, we want you to be, a car ride away. So Syracuse ended up being a perfect opportunity for me to study, but also have the big football games on Saturday afternoons and all of the big, classic university opportunities and activities that you would get as a college co-ed.
But it sounds as though from day one almost you were confident you could make a career out of doing these things you loved.
I was confident just because I think Broadway was so close and I knew that it was an audition away. I didn't come from a small town thinking, oh my God, what is New York all about? I knew, I was exposed to it.
Delius next.
Yes.
This piece, what attracts you to it?
I think I'm a dreamer, and it's just such impressionistic music. It's muted and pastel and just lives that gorgeous art in my mind when I hear it, and it's just dreamy.
Well, of course, it's called Ermeline Rose, and it's number 5 of the 7 Danish songs.
Hear the storm of love that comes from afar. By the
Prinzessin, you can fast say. Yet
you fancy singing that yourself? When do you imagine yourself in the voice, as it were?
Well, I'm not a soprano. I'm a mezzo at best, but my mother was a soprano, and Renee Fleming is a good friend of mine, and we did a concert together during COVID, and such an extraordinary talent. But my mother's been able to, you know, listen to her and appreciate all the greats that I've gotten a chance to work with.
Yeah, actually, being a mezzo and singing with a soprano is a bit like being a horn player and playing with your father playing the flute.
Yes, exactly.
We heard Ermeline Rose, number 5 of the 7 Danish songs by Frederik Delius, sung by Henriette Bond Hansen with the Aarhus Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Bo Holten. I think you cut short your university course when you were crowned Miss America 1984, if you can bear to think back to all of that. What was the experience of winning like?
Well, I was supposed to come to London and do my semester abroad, so I had no idea I was going to win. I had completed my second year, first year of your it's your core year, you're not allowed to perform. So you're doing, you know, piano and vocals and stagecraft and all kinds of stuff. My sophomore year was when I could perform, and I ended up getting parts and everything. There was a friend of mine who was a classmate whose friend was on the board and saw me in a couple of things and said, do you think she'd want to perform in the local pageant? And I had poo-pooed it and said, no, I don't. I had no intention of being a beauty queen or competing. And I had auditioned for Cyrano de Bergerac, and I got the part of an orange girl, which would have been, you know, a small little part, but it was an Equity production, which would have gotten me Equity points to be a professional. And the show got canceled, and that was in April, and I had April free. And I called my mom. I said, do you think I should do this Miss Syracuse pageant? She's like, is there scholarship money? And I said, yeah. I said, then do it. So I won that in April, and then New York State won that in July, and then in September of 83, won Miss America. So within 6 months, my life completely changed from being a co-ed, hoping to come to London for my semester abroad and not making it to London.
You were the first Black American mm-hmm. to win. Mm-hmm. That's sort of quite an important responsibility in a way, isn't it, Paul?
Absolutely. And of course, not being really prepared because I had no idea that it would actually happen to me that year, turning 20 and change my life. So it was a quick lesson to grow up really, really fast.
Well, particularly since in July 1984, the Miss America Organizing Committee forced you to resign and give up your title after the unauthorized publication of revealing photographs. What was it like being in the eye of a storm like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, they forced an answer, and I decided to resign. At that point, I had basically finished 10 months before I was going to turn over the crown, and some photographs that had no permission to be released were released and published, and they obviously said, you know, you need to make a decision. I resigned, I had a lawsuit, and then I just, I was 21 years old, and I said, I want to get on with my life and live out my dream, and albeit it was, a long struggle to be taken seriously, and it was a rough road.
Yeah, so you went into, you know, almost over the course of a year, experiencing what most people would never imagine experiencing, but both the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. You even received death threats and things, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Death threats that would come to the house, certain areas that I would visit as Miss America, they would say, stay in your room, please. Being in parades, and one particular parade, I got loaded up in the car, and then all of a sudden they said, no, I was supposed to be in a convertible, and they said, no, we're gonna close this. So
quite frightening.
It's frightening, and I didn't realize the severity of it. My parents obviously didn't want me to get freaked out, but they were aware. The FBI they were in contact, and they had a box of threatening letters, and so they knew. Mm-hmm.
In 2015, you received an apology from the CEO of Miss America, 32 years after you were forced to give up your title. That must have been meant something to you, that they realized that they'd got this wrong.
Well, at the time, the CEO, Sam Haskell, was one of the people when I got crowned, and you know, he was an agent in Hollywood and watched my career and was a fan. So I could trust him saying, listen, we want to do this. But I say that this was all for my mom. She got her apology because, you know, she knew how they treated my parents and me and how severe it was. And, you know, I had done the best job that I could at the time that I had.
Very appropriately, Vanessa Williams, we've got now a song about the very fragility of happiness, haven't we?
Yeah. Jobim and Brazil just remind me of that perfect combination of worlds colliding with the African undertone of the Portuguese melodies. And this is from the film Black Orpheus, which is tumultuous and romantic, and the stakes are always high.
Winning and danger combined.
Yes, there we go. Again.
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim. A felicidade é como a gota de orvalho numa pétala de flor. Brilha tranquila, depois de leve oscila e cai como uma lágrima de amor. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha o ano inteiro por um momento de sonho pra fazer a fantasia de rei ou de pirata ou jardineira. E tudo se acabar na quarta-feira. Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim. A felicidade é como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tenha vida breve, precisa que haja vento sem parar. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. Tristeza não tem fim.
So sadness has no ending, but happiness does.
Our Felicidade from the film Black Orpheus, composed and performed by Antonio Carlos Jobim. After the debacle of Miss America, you were saying that it was quite hard to pick up your career.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, not only am I 21 years old, but I'm now a beauty queen, which kind of negates any kind of talent and intellect. And now I'm a scandalized beauty queen, which is even worse. So, you know, I had a musical theater background. I had auditioned for My One and Only, which was a Gershwin musical that Tommy Tune was starring in. Twiggy was the co-star, and Mike Nichols was the director. We had an opportunity for me to learn everything and audition, and did a great job. And Mike Nichols turned to Lee Gershwin, who was Ira Gershwin's widow, who was head of the estate, and said, "Wasn't she terrific?" By the time he went backstage and the phone rang and he said, "Over my dead body, will that whore be in my show?" And he told me this later on, exactly what she had said. I knew that I didn't get the part and I knew that I nailed the audition, but I didn't realize how severe the judgment was at the time. Thank God. So that's just one instance where my brand, you know, so to speak, was really had blockades on every measure, whether it was music, whether it was theater, film, television. It was a no.
Yeah, but you came through this, you triumphed. But I think it was partially because of the support of your family and particularly your grandmother.
My grandmother was amazing, but I would say my community, my family, my community certainly believed in me. And then I also didn't stop. I didn't let no get in the way. And I found a way to, I think, find the right people that did believe in me. I mean, my publicist who helped me with everything ended up being my boyfriend, then my fiance, then my husband, and then my my manager. So I knew that he believed in me and knew what I could do. And I kind of just fortified myself with the right people that had my vision in mind and would help me get there.
Music for cello, fiddle, double bass, and mandolin now. It's called Goat Rodeo. Where did you get this?
So I had worked with Yo-Yo Ma for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra's 100th, their centennial year. And so this was 1999. And I have a beautiful arrangement called I Never Has Seen Snow, which is from House of Flowers, a Broadway musical. And Rob Mathis did this arrangement for me and Yo-Yo Ma at the time. And just the beginning, you could feel and hear the snow falling on top of your head. And it's airy and picturesque, but also has this kind of lopey groove. I still do it, and Rob still conducts, and it's always the mark of, can they play as well as Yo-Yo Ma? And we grade them. and we've had some spectacular ones and ones that were not so great. But loved working with Yo-Yo Ma. And when this Goat Rodeo CD came out, I just loved all of it because it has that kind of nod to Americana music with amazing orchestral technique. But it's fun and it's sassy and it's just very kind of organic. Thank you.
Great fun, isn't it? It really has that wonderful feeling that you get when a bunch of musicians get together and throw ideas at each other and respond to those ideas.
Exactly, like a great jam session.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. I remember Andre Previn telling me once that this was something that American musicians in particular were very good at syncopating, playing lazy, you know, going across the beat and that sort of thing.
And probably because the jazz roots, you know, which, you know, are truly American, for sure. Yeah.
Of course, your musical friend Aaron Copland did a wonderful rodeo, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
But that was Goat Rodeo, composed and played by Stuart Duncan, playing the fiddle. We heard Edgar Meyer, the double bass, and Chris Thiele, the mandolin, with Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the singer and actress Vanessa Williams. You've had such a varied career, Vanessa. An early string to your bow was your success in the music business. You released your debut album in 1988, and the song Save the Best for Last topped the American charts. What was it about this song that so spoke to people, do you think?
I think it's the melody. I truly think that good melody lasts the test of time when it, you know, turns into an earworm and they can't stop hearing it in their brains, but also when they can sing along. I mean, I understand that a lot of singers now feel that they need to do all the tricks, all the riffs, all the slides, and I understand it. But when people can sing along with ease, that's the test of time. And it was one of those, you know, demos that came across, and Wendy Waldman was singing it, who's one of the co-writers, and Phil Galston was playing piano, who's one of the co-writers, and John Lind, the third co-writer. It was just, I don't want to say simple, but it was haunting. And I said, wow, that I had no idea that it would last on the charts for as long as it did. And I remember the night of the Grammys when Eric Clapton won for Tears in Heaven, which was number two the whole time and never made it to number one. And he acknowledged me when he when he received
through
the award.
Through gritted teeth.
Exactly. I was like, yes. but, you know, it was that success was enormous. But I also think that, you know, you can tell that it was one take. You can tell that it was emotional and painted a picture where people can feel the sentiment.
In 1996, you performed the national anthem at the Super Bowl. I don't know if a British audience can imagine how important that is, a TV audience averaging around 100 million people. And just a decade after your very public fall from grace. At the time, did you stop and think, gosh, what an extraordinary turnaround?
I think not. I never kind of looked back because I was always like, what's next? And I also, while I was doing my career, also was having children. So in 1996, at that point, I already had three children. So I was in pure mom mode. Let me do the Super Bowl and let me get them to back to school, you know, the following week. So I think I never had a chance to kind of reflect or get mired in the tragedy of it all, you know.
Look forward to the next thing.
Absolutely.
Talking about wonderful tunes that are sort of earworms, and also another taste of America, it's Leonard Bernstein now.
West Side Story, my favorite musical of all time. Bernstein is just talking about passion and being a genius. I got a chance to sing. Never got a chance to do the actual show, but I got a chance to sing two of the pieces that Anita does in West Side Story with Harolyn Blackwell, who's a friend of mine, an amazing soprano. And right after I had done Kiss of the Spider Woman on Broadway in 1994-95, she was working on this piece, so I got a chance to do it while I was on Broadway. And West Side Story has, it just ticks all the boxes. It's thrilling. And at that time, I was stepping into Cheetah Rivera's shoes because she originated the role of Kiss of the Spider Woman. So I was replacing her on Broadway and then singing Anita in West Side Story, which she made popular and originated that role on Broadway. So a lot of synchronistic things were happening at the same time.
And of course, this manages to combine so many things. It's great lyric, it's great melody, and it's got such a rhythmic kick.
Yes, absolutely.
Very small. wants one thing only, and when he's done, he'll leave you lonely. He'll murder your love, he murdered mine. Just wait and see, just wait, Maria, just wait and see.
Oh, Juanita, no, Juanita, no. It isn't true, not for me. It's true for you, not for me. I hear your words, and in my head, I know the smart. But my heart, Juanita, but my heart
like
knows the wrong. And my heart,
forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind, stick to your own kind.
To him alone, one thing I know.
A boy who kills cannot love.
I don't care.
A boy who kills
what he
has
is.
No heart.
I don't know.
And he's the boy who gets your love.
So you said you should know better.
America and a Boy Like That from West Side Story, with music by Leonard Bernstein, lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, sung by Harolyn Blackwell and Vanessa Williams with a Simple Song Orchestra. It must have been such fun to do that.
It was amazing. And you know, not only singing a classic, but then getting a chance to work with Stephen Sondheim in my career shortly thereafter. That was 1995. And then in 2002, I did Into the Woods with him. And then in 2010, I did Sondheim on Sondheim with him and James Lapine as well. So you're a student learning these masterpieces, and then you've got the composer's name in your phone and you're having dinner. That's what, that freaks me out. The fact that, you know, went to his beautiful townhome and got a chance to know him as a person was one of the joys of life.
I think he even wrote some additional lyrics for you, didn't he?
Yes, he did. When we were doing Into the Woods, we were doing a I guess a revival, but they wanted to change some things. And for The Last Midnight, I played The Witch, and that was kind of her 11th hour number. And he wanted to write some additional lyrics. And I remember being on 890 Broadway with James Lapine in the rehearsal room. And back then we had a fax machine, and the fax lyrics would be coming on the fax. And James would be, we'd be standing together, and he would read and say, The witch's hand smothers the baby and kills the baby. So, oh, Steve, we're not going to kill the baby. Okay, we're not going to kill the baby. And I was like, well, I'll kill the baby. If Stephen wants me to, I will kill the baby.
Did you rather enjoy the darker side of humanity here?
I did, absolutely.
An Irish song next, Vanessa.
Yes. So this was one of those just special moments where you just never know what's going to happen. On Saturdays, my daughters would take dance class. We'd continue the routine in my household. And on Saturday mornings, I would drive them to dance class. And I was kind of getting sick of just pop radio. And WFUV is Fordham University's radio. And they have, on Saturday mornings, back in the day, they would have Irish music. So I would turn on the Irish music, put the kids in the car, and we would drive to their classes. And they were like, oh, Mom, not again, not with the Irish music. And they couldn't listen to their pop tunes, but I wanted them to get a breakout. And one time I was listening and I heard this kind of like, it was whistle and flute, but it was rhythmic and kind of funky. And I was like, who is this? So I called WFUV and I called the DJ and I said, can you tell me who you just played? And they told me about Cormac and Martin. And I mentioned who I was. And said, by the way, your father was my music teacher. I said, of course he was. Because everywhere I went, I would go through the security line for an airplane and someone would say, your mom was my music teacher. Your father was my music teacher. So that always happened. So I ended up getting 10 CDs because I loved it so much. And I was working on a Christmas album, my second Christmas album with Rob Mathis. And we said, how about, we were doing it at Abbey Road, doing the strings, and I said, how about we invite Cormac and Martin to come and play on the album? So we did a version of The Holly and the Ivy, flew them over from Dublin. It was wonderful to meet them. And then when I did my Christmas concert at the Palace, we ended up flying them in, and they actually performed with us. So going from hearing them on a college radio station to performing on Broadway with me all happened within a year or so.
And this song's called Cufflink. Part of Cufflink, music for whistle and guitar by Cormac Brannock and Martin Dunley. You know, we were talking earlier, Vanessa, about how music takes you to places, and indeed you go to places to experience it. But that takes me straight into the back room of a pub in Dublin. Or indeed any pub in Ireland,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely. It's got that rhythm and that feel that you just want to enjoy, and also that kind of jam session, you know, stumbling onto two amazing people that are just riffing off each other.
Vanessa, you've also enjoyed a successful career in television, especially in the show Ugly Betty. It had a pilot in 2006. What did you think at the time when you got involved in that?
2006, my father just died unexpectedly. It was pilot season, so that's when all the new pilots are being filmed. And I really didn't want to do anything. And I'd gotten an inquiry about this pilot called Ugly Betty. And I said, you know what, I'm going to Egypt with my family. If you can find me, fine. If not, let it go. So they ended up casting somebody else for the role of Wilhelmina Slater. And then I got a phone call saying, we want you to show up tomorrow. So I did the pilot, and it was a great concept and very unusual. Nothing was like that on television. And I said, that was fun. I doubt they'll ever pick it up, but that was fun. And then they ended up picking it up a couple months later. And then we were on Friday nights, slated for Friday night, which was kind of it's not the throwaway time slot, but it's not prime time. And while we were at the TCAs, which is the Television Critics Awards, we were on a panel, and a lot of the writers kept saying, this is the best thing that ABC has this season. So with that kind of rumblings, we ended up being right in front of Grey's Anatomy, which was a gigantic hit, and that helped our numbers and also get us an audience that, now that they're streaming, I mean, I have a whole new people that are young and weren't even alive during the original Ugly Betty that are discovering it.
It had a very unusually diverse cast, didn't it, with an American-Mexican character leading?
Yeah, Ugly Betty was a Colombian series that was adapted for the United States. But the fact that we got a chance to make it a hit in the States and then, you know, worldwide was wonderful.
You spent 4 years playing Wilhelmina Slater. Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say she was something of a vindictive schemer?
Yes. You know, Wilhelmina was always looking at the prize and never quite getting it. She wanted to be editor-in-chief of Mode magazine for those 4 years. You know, I tend to get these characters that they start out to be unlikable, and my goal is to make them be understood. You don't have to like them, but you understand why they are such such terrors.
Well, you've also starred in Hollywood films, notably Eraser, opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger. And again, I don't think you were the director's first choice, were you?
No, I was not the producer's first choice. I wasn't the director's first choice. But I did a screen test with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And kind of while they're setting up the lights and cameras, we were talking, and he said, listen, we were both viewed. He was Mr. Universe, I was Miss America. We were both viewed and judged on all this external stuff. And of course, he was a gigantic success. And at that time, I was as well. And said, people counted us out. And that's kind of how we bonded and ended up getting the part and being an Eraser, 1996.
So you had a kind of connection with him, really, through what you've both been through.
I think absolutely.
Yeah. Music by Samuel Barber next, another great American composer of the same kind of generation as Copland, actually.
Yes, and this was from the opera Vanessa, and that's what I'm named after.
Well, I was going to say, no, the opera surely was named after you.
Yes, my mother was a big fan, and this is just personal and lovely.
You mentioned earlier Renee Fleming, but we've got another wonderful singer here, Frederica von Stade.
Yes, never met her, but yes.
And what is she singing? She's singing Must the Winter Come So Soon.
Yes, it's time. The older I get, I'm 62, and it just seems like time is so fleeting. It just reminds you that time speeds by so quickly, and to enjoy every moment, because the season will change and it's on to the next chapter.
Yes, the winter comes soon.
Must the Winter Come So Soon, from Samuel Barber's opera Vanessa, sung by the soprano Frederica von Stade, with James Conlon conducting the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Vanessa Williams, it's been more than 40 years since you were the first black Miss America. There have been many more since you were crowned. But I'm wondering whether you've seen changes in your chosen industry too, in theatre, in film.
Absolutely. I am so fortunate to be a part of Black Theatre United, which is a group that we established in 2020, and it is for equity and diversity and inclusion, accessibility, belonging within the theatre community. And we, as BTU, have been able to create a document called The New Deal, which the signatories include theater owners and producers and creators and industry leaders that all have made a commitment to make sure that the landscape of theater is diverse, not only on stage, but behind stage, and ownership and creative teams. So that's been incredible to be able to have a goal and actually achieve it.
Well, I noticed the mixture in the cast that you're performing in The Devil Wears Prada at the moment in London. And it must be interesting to take a role made famous, of course, by Meryl Streep in the film and make it your own, which you very much do.
Thank you. It's something that I love to do. I've been able to, you know, walk into when I did Kiss of the Spider Woman, Cheetah Rivera was Latino and I got a chance to play, you know, Spider Woman. I've done Bye Bye Birdie for television. And again, another Cheetah Rivera role. And as a black woman, step into Rosie with that. So I've been able to kind of do it my entire career. And I'm happy that it's getting better and better.
Is it important having live musicians as well as the dancers and the singers in The Devil Wears Prada?
Absolutely. You know, there's no substitute for tempo and feeling and the audience.
And the ability to change, yes, depending on the audience.
That's
because when
theater,
I first went into the theatre, I thought, are you doing this to a track? And then, of course, I realised the musicians were there.
Yeah. It's the audience informs your performance. And sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's slower. Sometimes you want to take a little more time and finesse it. And that's why the conductor is watching you. And it's a relationship, for sure. And obviously the band and the musicians are following the lead of what they're hearing, but also the conductor. So that's why I love theater so much. Everyone says, oh, you do it 8 shows a week. Don't you get bored? I said, it's always different every night.
Yeah. And of course, there are things like you can see the conductor on a monitor, presumably, but they are, as you say, following you. So if you get to the end of a phrase, like an Italian bel canto singer, and you want to go bong, bump, bump,
yes,
the conductor's watching to,
yes,
get that downbeat.
Absolutely.
Well, the upbeat, even more important.
Absolutely.
Now, I think it's continuing the role, isn't it, until April 2026, The Devil Wears Prada.
Or beyond. We're in negotiations now, so yeah, probably it'll be continuing through the rest of the year.
I'm afraid we've come to your final choice, Vanessa. What is it?
It is Blue Cathedral by Jennifer Higdon. And I loved her because she was a female composer, so I wanted to give her her flowers. Again, we've got the Second Atlantic Symphony Orchestra. I've performed with them before, so they're fantastic orchestra. And again, it's back to my dreamy side. I love to listen to music and just dream and paint a picture in my mind, and this is just extraordinary.
Vanessa Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The opening of Jennifer Higdon's Blue Cathedral, performed by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra with the conductor Robert Sparno. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the Broadway star Vanessa Williams. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman. Next week, Michael's guest will be the TV presenter Peter Purvis.
Music Matters on BBC Radio 3.
What's the relationship between American classical music and American political history?
I think there's an immediacy to American music. I think there's an honesty, like what you see is what you get.
In the year that marks the 250th anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence, I want to explore how American classical music has reflected that nation's evolving sense of itself. The President and the Polka, with me, Justin Webb. To listen, just search Music Matters on BBC Sounds.
Good afternoon. Emily Jeffrey here with you on Radio 3. Hope you're having a good Sunday so far. Choral Evensong on the way at 3. And this week, a service from Fifth Avenue in New York. And after that, at 4 o'clock, Alan Shipton is here with Jazz Record Requests. But now, at 1:30, it's time to join Sarah Moore-Peach for a musical journey with a Czech flavour, taking in the worlds of Franz Schubert, Edward Elgar, Nancy Dalberg and Astor Piazzolla along the way.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we plot a single piece of classical music within a landscape of connections, like a musical Venn diagram, meandering through a playlist that explores different aspects of our chosen piece, and at the end of the show, we hear it in full. Today, our destination is the sparkling orchestral music of the 19th century Czech composer Antonín Dvořák. Dvořák's Scherzo Capriccioso, a much-loved orchestral fantasy from 1883. And although there is plenty of sparkle, courtesy of swinging waltzes and triangles, which we'll get to later, there is also a darkness that pulls at the music. It packs a vast amount into its 15 minutes. The title that Dvořák chose for his piece is interesting because it gives him all the license he needs to go wherever he wants in terms of form and mood. Scherzo Capriccioso. Scherzo, a playful musical form without a great deal of structure, and capricious, meaning sudden changes of mood or atmosphere, or, as in this case, at the mercy of the whims of a virtuoso.